Robert Gates said it relatively recently, say, let's put an Afghan mask, an Afghan face on the war. And this is just a commonplace thing. And it means, let's get an Afghan out front. But if you think about that phrase for a minute, an Afghan face is, of course, a mask over, really, an American war. And often the words that they use, the images that they use, are very telling, if you just look barely under them, about what they think about who's actually running what war. I mean, you can really see in our language that we feel this is ours, it should be ours, you know, it's our war. I mean, this has the Afghans are ancillary to the war we're fighting.
How do you propose pulling out? How do you propose Obama get out?
Well, let me say as a start that one of the problems with answering a question like this is, you know, basically, we've never tried it. I mean, in other words, it's like talking about peace. All the money goes into war. So you know, and in addition, as you try to get out, as was true in Vietnam for years, future fantasies are put forward. You know, there's going to be a bloodbath, terrible things will happen. We don't know what actually will happen in Afghanistan. If we were to pull out, we know what's happening now, and it's quite terrible, and it's actually devolving. I mean, I think it's perfectly reasonable whether you, I mean, you could simply announce a withdrawal, a reasonable withdrawal schedule, and pull out American troops. You could offer money. We really don't know. I think it's very unlikely, for instance, that the Taliban would simply take over the country. They didn't the last time. They might get part of the country, but not all of it. We really don't know what would happen. We just know that this will otherwise be a trillion-dollar war, which, like the Soviet war, will go on forever and ever. I mean, the Soviets, from about 1986 on, for about the last 3 or 4 years, they wanted to get out. The Soviet leadership, you look at their documents, they want to get out, but they can't muster the will. They keep worrying, will Afghanistan be stable, et cetera, et cetera. It goes on for years. And the problem isn't how will we get out of Afghanistan, but when Obama decides he wants to, it's going to be difficult.
And this most recent announcement about the vast mineral wealth in Afghanistan, especially coming, the timing of it, as the war is actually not progressing as well as the Obama administration had hoped. Is it your sense that this was more sort of rallying the corporate and financial elites of the world to take more renewed interest in supporting the U.S. effort?
I'm not convinced it's going to have that effect, actually. First of all, as you can see from the Times today, the Times had a piece on it today, and as was true with Iraq, it's very hard to get Western, these big Western mining companies, to come into a situation where, you know, the lithium that they're talking about is basically under lands that basically are Taliban-controlled right now. They don't want to send their people in there. The people who might come in are the Chinese, maybe, who would be willing to take more risks, or various state mining interests that we wouldn't be interested in. So I'm not sure this is a great benefit in that sense. Secondly, you know, to get in a country with almost no infrastructure and no mining infrastructure, to get anything out of the ground there, I mean, I'm sure you're talking a decade. You're not talking about now. You're not talking about something striking that's going to happen now. I think, yeah, I mean, it was a kind of a good news story at a bad news time. And it is significant that there's all this stuff under Afghanistan, which was known.
It's not as if it wasn't known. And no. The question is why it's being raised as a story now, if not to justify the U.S.'s continued presence, that maybe the U.S. can get these natural resources.
Let's point out that it was known by the Russians. You know, in the Russian war, the Russians knew this. I mean, I'm struck by one small thing. Mikhail Gorbachev, the Russian leader who did finally get them out, his term for Afghanistan was the bleeding wound. Our Afghan war commander recently referred to his kind of pet offensive in the small southern area of Marja, where they threw in 15,000 troops in the spring, declared it a victory, and now find out that things are not going well. He's called it a bleeding ulcer. There is kind of an eerie parallel there, and it reminds us that both countries will now have been in a war in Afghanistan, a place known as the graveyard of empires, for a decade.
You talk about finally garrisoning of the planet.
Yes. Well, the American way of war, which is the title of my book, is based on something that in the United States we have basically no interest in. Unless a base closes in the United States and then there's an enormous uproar, a military base, we really don't think much about our basing policy around the world. And yet,
10 seconds, then we go to a web special after.
And yet we have maybe up to 1,200 bases, depending on what you're counting, maybe even more, around the world. We basically garrison the planet. Washington is a war capital. We are in a state of war. We don't know it.
Tom Engelhardt, congratulations on your new book, The American Way of War, How Bush's Wars Become Obama's. We're going to continue this after the show and put it up at democracynow.org. That does it for our broadcast. We want to wish a very fond farewell to Democracy Now!'s chief engineer, Peter Kurys. For the past 2.5 years, he's seen us through thick and thin in our daily broadcast and helped us build and transition to our new studio. Peter, thank you for everything. We will miss you here. Good luck as your new broadcast engineer at CUNY with all that you do. And it, of course, it means we now have a new job opening for chief broadcast engineer. You can go to our website at democracynow.org for details. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 8 a.m. Stay tuned next for Positively Revolting. Melinda Bernard guest hosts a discussion of how social media and activism affect journalism with a panel of journalists coming up right after these announcements. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Over the Rainbow Transformations, Portland's full-service cross-dressing boutique, offering everything to create and maintain your feminine appearance, including salon beauty services. We are here for all cross-dressers and transgendered ladies. Information and events calendar at 503-235-3452 or victoriasrainbow.com.
Hi, I'm Dr. David Naiman, host of Health Watch. Join me this Monday at 11 when I speak with the author of The Secret Life of the Grown-Up Brain. Learn how the brain's capacity actually reaches its peak in middle age and how we can maintain optimal brain function throughout our lives. That's this Monday at 11 on Health Watch.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland's Gay and Lesbian Community Yellow Pages, providing a wide array of gay-friendly business listings. For more information, you can call 503-230-7701 or you can visit them on the web at www.pdxgayyellowpages.com.
Good morning, and welcome to Positively Revolting Talk. I'm your guest host this morning, Melinda Bernard, sitting in for Ani and Lynn, who are on a well-deserved vacation. We're talking about social media this morning and how the popularity of Facebook, Twitter, and blogging is changing activism, journalism, and what that means for all of us. I have several guests this morning. Joining us from Las Vegas is Steve Sebelius, editor of the alternative weekly City Life. From Bellevue, Washington, we have MSN senior producer Rick Vanderknife. And with me in the studio is the founder of My Little Waiting Room, Amy Patterson. Amy, let's start with your story. A very difficult experience led to a grassroots effort to help others. Can you tell our listeners about My Little Waiting Room and how you use social media to promote your project?
Sure. Thanks, Melinda. Thanks for the opportunity to be here this morning. My organization, My Little Waiting Room, was started 3 years ago by me and a friend after I'd gone through a year of treatment for breast cancer while mothering my 2.5-year-old. And after I was done with treatment, my friend said, gee, I bet you learned so much that could really help other families and who are going through the same thing. And I said, you know what would have been so helpful was if they could have had on-site drop-in childcare at the hospital, just like they have at the community center and at the gym and so many other places, even stores like Fred Meyer and IKEA. And so she said, well, that's a great idea, and I think that we could really get some grant funding to do that. So, you know, after hours and in between our family lives, we started putting together our vision, researching the concept. It's such a simple and an obvious idea, we kind of couldn't believe that it didn't already exist somewhere. And we did find a handful of other hospitals who are in other parts of the country who are willing to share how they were providing on-site childcare for patients and their visitors at hospitals. And so we learned from them, and we just started making our case to anyone who would listen. And I think that we were really lucky with our timing because social media was really starting to emerge at that time. And so here we were, just two moms with a laptop and some cell phones, trying to make the case for something that we believed in. And we were able to take advantage of all of these free and very easy-to-use tools to get our message out online, which then would lead to media coverage both online but then also through traditional means. And each one kind of fed each other. We participated in a program called the Members Project that American Express sponsors. And as part of that project, they invite all of their members to vote on the ideas for social change that they believe will be the most meaningful. And American Express says, we'll fund these projects, but you got to tell us what to fund.
I remember seeing this on Facebook, I believe.
Right.
I believe we voted on, and I voted for yours. And
thank you.
How did the vote turn out for you?
We did really great. We were ultimately one of the top 25 projects, and so in the country.
Wonderful.
So 1,200 projects, we ended up number 13, which wasn't enough to get us funding. But what it was able to do was we had more than 20,000 people click on our site, and we had hundreds of comments. We had the fourth most number of comments of any of the projects. And so we really saw it as our free national advertising campaign to get the word out about what we wanted to do. And it ended up bringing lots of influential people to us who were then able to help open doors and for funding and also to ultimately lead to our project partner here in Portland, Providence St. Vincent Medical Center, who we've partnered with to open the first My Little Waiting Room right here in Portland.
And I believe you had your grand opening just a few months ago, right?
We did. We opened in April, and we're open from 9 to 3, Monday through Friday, and we offer free drop-in or reservation-based childcare for patients and their visitors at Providence St. Vincent Medical Center. And in the few short months that we've been open, we've had more than 600 families able to get to their important medical appointments and to be together at the hospital. And it's also a service that's underwritten entirely by donations, and so it's free to patients and their visitors.
That is amazing. And do you have a Facebook page for My Little Waiting Room?
We have a Facebook page for My Little Waiting Room. And over the course of the last couple of years, it's been a great format for us just to tell our story of how we've been trying to get the word out about our project and then finding our partner and then building it. So we share pictures and fun little wins and things that are happening, grants that are coming in. And we now have about 320 fans on our page, and it grows every day.
That is wonderful. Now, as a PR professional, obviously public relations and journalists have had a long history of working together. Mostly good, sometimes not so good. And I've always thought that Facebook would be the great kind of levelizer to help public relations people, journalists, understand each other and get more, sometimes a clearer picture of what we both do. Joining us from Las Vegas this morning is Steve Sebelius, City Life editor. Good morning, Steve.
How you doing?
Excellent. Thanks for being on KBOO this morning. As you know, we're talking about social media, and I was wondering if you could just give our listeners a brief idea of how social media works with your newspaper.
Well, it's we try to integrate it as much as possible. I know I personally do. I write about mostly politics, and so I kind of adapt each different kind of social media to what it's best used for. For example, Twitter is best used for breaking news. That's something that's going on right now. Also for a little bit of commentary sometimes, and to point somebody back to an original article that we may have had on the web or on the newspaper's website. And I know I have on my website, which is /politics.com, I've got the Twitter feed that we have right there, in addition to blogs and then news from elsewhere. And so the goal was to make it kind of a one-stop shop for people looking for political news. But I find that social media is just becoming, I mean, you have to be doing it now. It's if you're not on Twitter, if you're not on Facebook, if you're not out there as a journalist, it's almost like you don't exist. It's just a completely indispensable way to talk about news.
Well, that brings us to Rick Vanderknife. Rick, you're a former journalist, and now you're a senior producer at MSN. What kind of impact has Facebook, Twitter, and other social media had on MSN?
Well, it's been kind of an interesting time because MSN has had its own take on social media before Facebook, with IM and Hotmail and other communication tools and spaces, and it has, unlike a lot of places, it has a very big native audience, about 60 million U.S. users. So I think we've entered kind of gingerly in terms of directly with Facebook and Twitter, but we've sort of really embraced it probably in the last 6 months or so. When we relaunched the MSN.com homepage, in March, we've integrated Facebook and Twitter right on the page. So, you can come to MSN.com and still sort of check on your news feed from Facebook or, whoever you're following on Twitter. We've integrated Facebook commenting on some of our points of our site, and we've seen a huge uptake in the amount of conversation that happens around some of our video and editorial content. I think we're definitely going to see more and more of that integration. It's definitely something MSN is starting to embrace.
What kind of impact, Rick, do you see from your end that Facebook and Twitter and social media in general, blogging, has had on just the internet in general? I know that oftentimes on my Facebook page, someone will link a story from, say, the Huffington Post, or from somebody a show that I particularly like Democracy Now, and that'll cause me to link over. Do you find that that's becoming more the case?
I think that's definitely become the case. I think instead of, most news providers have realized that people aren't just going to come to their homepage and browse the news and sort of, take in the news as they present it. People are becoming distributors of news themselves. They're the ones who are finding things. People are reading news that is passed on to them by their trusted circle. So people become distributors of news, and I think that's what everybody's trying to tap into, and people are finding a lot of success. I mean, 2 years ago, I think the Holy Grail, if you were a news provider like Huffington Post or something, is like, we've got to optimize for Google. It's all about Google referrals. I think with changing content like news, Facebook is becoming a much more effective way of sort of spreading the word and making it easy for people to share your content. I think it's just, like Steve said, it's the price of entry now to be in the news business.
And Steve, what do you think, what kind of impact do you think that the social media and citizen journalism is having on the quality of journalism? As we all know, most of us who started out in journalism covered school board meetings, city council meetings in very small towns, and oftentimes I can say, at least for myself, I wouldn't have been there if I hadn't been being paid. And some of the greatest stories I found were generated out of the city council meetings, but most of them were long, dull affairs.
Yes, and I can say that having watched one just recently, yes, they are still long and dull affairs. So, but I think now you have, as you said, their reporters are paid to be there, and that's a good thing because the reporters don't have an agenda. They're not there to be pro or con on any particular item. They're just there to find out what happens. Sometimes with with citizen journalism. You have people who are there who have an agenda, who, you know, are against a particular item, and they're going to report it that way on their website, on their blog, on their Twitter. Now, that is not, there's still usefulness in that. You can still get something out of that. You can still get information out of that. But it's not the same as, you know, the journalists of the old time and still today, you know, go down there to do. So there is that issue to deal with.
And you're listening to Positively Revolting Talk on KBOO FM 90.7. The time is 8:15, and we are talking about social media this morning. And joining me is Amy Patterson of My Little Waiting Room, Steve Sobelius from Las Vegas City Life, and Rick Vanderknife from MSN. Amy, Steve was just talking about how now some citizen journalists, they're there for one topic, and they have just one focus. As a PR professional, how do you feel about the upcoming, you know, the uprising in citizen journalism? Is this something that PR or public relations professionals are changing on how they handle?
Yeah, it's an interesting issue. We certainly study it in my day job that I work in the PR industry when I'm not working on My Little Waiting Room, which is my volunteer work. What we're finding is that people are, as I think Steve said, with people becoming distributors of news for the very first time in my professional career, people can now be their own producers and publishers. So the playing field is extraordinarily level. And the really good news for organizations like My Little Waiting Room or some of the client organizations that we counsel is that for the first time, they can create their own news channels. So we look at it more from the standpoint of if you have a story to tell, you now have the vehicle to do that in a way that's never been done before. And then so often we try to work to engage then that news distribution system of these citizen journalists and other people who are maybe they're just casually sending links between friends, or maybe they have a blog that has a very focused and niche but highly engaged readership. So we look at media across the spectrum. It's not just pitching the TV station anymore and the radio station. It's pitching people who are out there blogging and being active in sharing news among each other.
So having a Twitter account, having a Facebook page, having a blog, is it something that you recommend for your clients?
It is, and it's something that we've really seen the power of just with My Little Waiting Room, being able to tell our story with our blog and then sharing information. And we're able to meet people when they're ready to be met with our news. So when someone is, say, we really have a lot of attention among the sort of mommy blogger sets. So after mom's put the kids to bed and she's sitting down at her computer and catching up on her email, catching up on her Facebook, she can come to our site and she can catch up on the news of the day, and including My Little Waiting Room's news of the day. So news is becoming more personalized. So we're able to find that we're able to get our story out to what is a niche audience, but the internet makes it become a national or international audience. So we have people from all over the country who come and follow what we're doing. So there are audiences out there, and it's just a matter of finding them, and there's some great new tools to help do that.
If you'd like to join the conversation, the number to call is area code 503-231-8187. Perhaps you are a citizen journalist, you are a blogger, or maybe you just love Facebook. Maybe you can't stand Facebook. Maybe you think that technology is ruining journalism and news gathering as a whole. We'd like to hear from you. The number once again is area code 503-231-8187. Steve, what do you think about the death of what people call the death of newspapers, which I see happening all over the country? Do you think that weeklies are filling a niche that the dailies just aren't making?
Yeah, I think certainly my paper, which I take I'm a little bit humble to compare to Willamette Week, since they've won a Pulitzer Prize and they're a great newspaper. We're kind of the equivalent of Willamette Week here in Las Vegas. And, you know, you worry initially coming out of daily newspaper journalism when you go into editing a weekly paper, you know, what are we going to write about? Is there going to be enough news to go around? And we have never once struggled to find news that either the daily paper ignored got wrong or wrote about but missed the real story. So I think we definitely have that niche to fill. And if you look across the country at these all weeklies, they are full of news that that you just don't find in the mainstream press.
And Rick, when you're talking about MSN and you're putting together the folks at MSN are putting together the pages, are they just do they just look at certain content or that there's certain media outlets perhaps that you only use? Do you think there'll ever be a time when there might be rotating certain blogs through or alternative, or are you strictly mostly like ABC, the news outlet medias that are pretty much traditional and have proven themselves?
Well, since I work on the part of MSN that's really locally focused, and you know, and for a good part of that, we work with our partners at MSNBC, which is our sort of news partner and 50% owned by Microsoft. So they have a lot of local news affiliates in certain markets that sort of fill our local news needs. But we're also surfacing a lot of content in other markets from small papers or mid to larger size papers, depending on the market. And we're also experimenting together with a team at the Maps division of Bing. They're crawling a lot of hyperlocal blogs across the country. I mean, thousands upon thousands of them. And we're starting to experiment with surfacing some of those within Local Edition, which is the sort of the local section of MSN. And as we expand the number of cities, we'll probably start to put those front and center. So we're surfacing a headline and a little snippet and inviting people to click off to the originating blog and start to explore, because we're really interested in sort of, you know, MSN is sort of an USA Today equivalent. It's national. It's big stories that drive a lot of traffic, but we want to be able to sort of flip that and also have a lot of compelling local content for people just to make MSN a richer experience. So, yeah, we're interested in reaching down to you know, here in Seattle, we're surfacing stuff from Capitol Hill blog and My Ballard and West Seattle blog and some of the political blogs here in Seattle. And I think we'll just continue to do more of that. MSNBC purchased Every Block, which is and we will probably start to integrate some of that stuff. It's rich local content about, you know, 911 calls and restaurant violations. So I think we're definitely interested in kind of spanning the spectrum from big headline news and feature stories down to what's happening in your neighborhood.
So is the 911 and the dirty dining sort of thing, is that equivalent to like the police blotter in a weekly newspaper or the crime roundup on a daily paper?
I think some of that is, yeah. And I think it's, you know, Every Block, which was sort of independently created and with the help of a Knight Foundation grant, is sort of trying to do that in a way that's automated. So there's a lot, you know, and the Obama administration is doing this too. They're trying to make a lot of this sort of public information available online in a way that anybody can consume and display. So some of the things that you had to go, you know, I remember having to go down to the police station and, you know, handwrite from the police logs, my weekly police log. And you know, some of that handwork and sort of the true labor, you know, we can sort of hand off to technology so that, you know, the dwindling number of reporters can spend their time doing reporting.
Okay, so who is exactly going to be gathering this information? Because as you said, most of us who started out in daily newspapers or even weekly newspapers, that was probably the most read and important for the community page of the newspaper. But it is tedious. You do have to go, and back in the day, you had to go back and handwrite it. I suppose you could do your sit there with your laptop. But unless, are you saying that it's coming directly from the police station? Or how would that be handled?
I think it really depends on market, and I think, I mean, if you look at Seattle as an interesting market with a lot of media experimentation, you find a lot of either small chains or very independent neighborhood level blogs that are doing the kinds of things people used to do at independent weekly papers or small dailies, and those people, and a lot of them are former, you know, newspaper journalists who are sort of, you know, forced by circumstance to do something entrepreneurial, and they're having a lot of success. So you find neighborhood level blogs where people are covering fires, covering council meetings, covering community meetings, generating discussion. I think a lot of that stuff is happening. I think just the sort of medium is changing a little bit, and it's a little bit of a Wild West period because some of these things are going to be successful and some won't. Big players will move in, like, you know, AOL is launching this patch initiative, and it's starting to move in Seattle. It's already moved into parts of California and the East Coast.
Can you explain that real briefly? What is it exactly that they're launching?
So Patch is owned by AOL. It was a startup that was doing neighborhood-level blogs, but they're trying to build a nationwide network of neighborhood-level blogs. And they're sort of doing it in a tiered style where they're hiring a few regional editors and then a bunch of really local editors, like there's a blog in Manhattan Beach, and sort of that level of community that might have been served by a weekly before will be served by a blogger. And it's a pretty rich experience, but AOL, is the estimates I see is that they're spending upwards of $50 million to put this network together.
Wow.
I don't know if it pays off in the end, but you sort of see this mix of, you know, people launching their own blogs and building and finding ways to make a living at it, coupled with big players trying to experiment and see what they can do in the local market. And then you see some really interesting sort of topical blogs that happened locally, like Seattle has Tech Flash, which is part of the Business Journal, but it's a technology blog that's just about Seattle tech businesses. Or you've got the Seattle Transit blog. I mean, we've got huge transit issues, and I think you find more in the Seattle Transit blog than you would have seen in the heyday of both Seattle papers. I mean, you get a rich, deep dive into a single topic that matters to people. So I think we're losing something, but I think there's some interesting stuff going on.
Okay. And what about in Las Vegas, Steve? What do you see happening in terms of citizen journalism and upstarts in your area?
There is some of that. You have some bloggers who've gotten in on the news. I think mostly here in our town, it's still done. The general news reporting is still done by the professional journalists and through their websites. Lumbering into the new world. But I think one thing, you know, that Rick and Amy kind of both hinted at. I'll never forget this story. Back in the after the New London versus Kelo decision, the Supreme Court said that a city could take a bunch of people's homes and turn it over to a developer who wanted to develop a shopping mall. Very controversial decision. I recall visiting my hometown in Huntington Beach and having one of my friends, who really is not a news junkie at all, talk to me about it. And he was just outraged by this decision, as most of America was, and he said he couldn't believe this decision. And what I couldn't believe is, you know, this guy who is not a news junkie, where did he find out about that? It wasn't the newspaper, it wasn't TV, it wasn't the internet, it wasn't a blog. It was actually a online home theater forum, and he is big into home theaters. And all these folks with their home theater forums are now worried that the government's going to come and take their home and turn it into a shopping mall. And so they were discussing it on that forum. And I realized at that moment that one of the keys to this is being able to kind of get your news into other people's pre-existing social networks, so that if you can get your story to them and have them talking about it, that is a way to spread the news, but it's a very non-traditional way, because you're not going to get them with a broadcast of news. You're not going to get them throwing the news on their doorstep, but you engage them where they're already talking about issues that seemingly have nothing to do with the news of the day, but do have an impact on them and could have an impact on them. And so I always remember that story as a way to say, look, you know, we've got our content over here, but people have their pre-existing social networks on Facebook and on Twitter and in their blogs and whatnot. And if you can figure out a way to get your news into that network, and Twitter's a way to do that, then you're gonna be successful in your mission, which is to get out the news.
Well, once again, it comes down to public relations. And how do people decide who they follow on Twitter, and how do they decide where they fit in this? Amy?
Sure. Well, and I would add to that, Melinda, what Rick and Steve were talking about in your question of who is writing the stories and who's doing the news gathering. If you are an organization with a story to tell, increasingly what we're finding is that news organizations are looking to experts to contribute stories. So it's a real opportunity to provide good news information as an organization and do that kind of reporting work and then see your story being told in news forums. And so there's a real opportunity there. In terms of getting your story out there, one of the things that I find as a PR person, and again, working with my little waiting room trying to get our story out there, is that using these new tools like Twitter and Facebook, we're able to be more targeted in finding the types of journalists who are covering stories like ours. And so we're able to connect with these people in a new way. It used to be that you kind of had to guess, and by golly, or you would look up on the internet, you know, what's this newspaper covering that's not my local newspaper? How do I find the people who are going to care about the story that I have to tell? And now it's just so much easier with journalists not only writing their stories, but also making their news really readily available through their tweets and through their Facebook pages. And so you're able to find who cares about your story and then go and connect with them in an easy way.
And you're listening to Positively Revolting Talk on KBOO FM. It is 8:30. This is Melinda Bernert. I'm guest host this morning, in for Ani and Lynn. If you'd like to join the conversation, we are talking about social media and how it affects activism and journalism. Our phone number is area code 503-231-8187. I'd like to go back to what, Amy, what you were saying about finding the right journalist, finding the right person to tell your story. Once you find that story, how do you know that you really have the quality that you're looking for? And this is an area that I wanted to look at. The social media is great. I have a Facebook page. I have a Twitter account. I love it all. Of course, I'm a news junkie, and just the immediacy is really exciting for me. But sometimes I'll click on a page, and let's say on my little waiting room wouldn't be a good example, but just some group. And I'll look through there, and oftentimes, first of all, the name of the group is misspelled, which drives me crazy. I see a lot of misspellings, and I start to question, well, do these people really have their information correct? Where do they get it? I guess that I, as a consumer of news, want to know that what I'm getting is a quality product, whether I'm paying for it, whether I'm reading it in a newspaper or online. And I'm wondering how we go about making sure that there is some kind of quality out there.
Sure. That's a great question. I think that if you're an organization putting your story out there, there are things that you can do to help make your position look more legitimate. And part of that are just the basics of spelling things correctly. So that will make you look more legitimate in the eyes of the person who might have stumbled upon you online. One of the things that also really helps in building that legitimacy and the role that traditional media still plays, and I think increasingly more importantly plays, is that they still have that sort of vetting process. And so they are doing the fact checking. And so when your organization can show that you've gotten some coverage in traditional news, it then feeds back into that legitimacy picture so that the person who's maybe come to your website will see that, oh, okay, you know, you've been covered by the local news. I think that that's an organization that has, you know, has their act together and has someone has kind of background checked what they're doing. So it kind of goes two ways. You need to put the information out there in a way that's easy to read and that is appears factual. And then also if you can get that story out. And you can start small. You can start, if you have a social advocacy project that you're working on, you can start by going to those really niche-y bloggers who are looking for information about things that you're doing. And then once you get that blog story, maybe then you can go to your local newspaper reporter and you can say, look, you know, this blog covered us. These are the issues. I think it's a story your readers might be interested in. And then you can kind of go up the ladder. And then from there, if that local journalist writes about you, then you can go to the local TV station and maybe from there go to a national newspaper, a national TV station. So you can kind of stair-step your way.
Great. Thank you. And I believe we have a caller. Good morning. Welcome to Positively Revolting Talk.
Good morning. I think you're discussing the presentation, how information that affects us information that's coming in about the world around us, how it affects us, and how it's presented to us. And for me, I have a little bit of a problem with the presentation, the blogging, and the getting on the computer and stuff, because I have to. There's other things I have to do, like work. I'm retired, but I have a farm and I have animals to feed. I'm always outside working, so I carry a radio around with me. And what I want in the way of information and how it's presented is I want to be there. And I would really like to see someone just cover the news by being there and letting me translate what it is that's happening. That's the reason I will not watch television. None of those people that are sitting behind those desks with their beautiful masks on have ever been at the situation that they're reporting on. In fact, some even laugh and smile after they've covered a disaster. So you know that they have nothing to do with reporting the news. I want to hear the news, and I want to translate it, because I'm hearing it. I'm hearing it, and I can translate myself. I have a brain, and I don't need it translated for me. And that's the problem I have with blogs and people presenting things to me. When Kibu used to cover the city council, it was great for me, because I could carry my radio around, listen to the city council all day. I knew everything that was happening in Multnomah County, though I didn't live in Multnomah County. I knew what was coming up. In fact, I probably I knew things that were going to be happening before they got in the Oregonian, months before, because they'd already been covered at the city council. But no one was going to the city council. No one goes there.
Right.
I got
right.
to translate.
Absolutely.
You understand my point?
Oh, yes. I know. You know, Rick, Steve, and myself have all started out in the trenches, and what we did is we reported, and you decided literally what we didn't do a news analysis for you. We didn't tell you how you should think. When you're a newspaper reporter and you're starting, especially when you're starting out, you're just giving the reader the facts. And in my opinion, that's the way it should be. If I want to have analysis, well, then great. I can go to Steve's column and read about politics in Las Vegas and get a particular slant. But somewhere first, I need to have the information, and I agree. So are you saying that your favorite format for news at this point is the radio?
I'm just audio. It's because of my lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I never watch television. I just don't know where it belongs in anyone's life, except for maybe putting a good movie on. But I'd like to go back to what you just said about what you just cover. You presented the information, and then whoever's listening can translate it. You know, translate that information however they feel it should be translated. Well, even when you are giving information, the intonation of your voice when you're giving it presents a prejudice. And what I'm saying is, get the microphone out there into the crowd. Get the microphone out there in front of that guy that's standing up in front of the city council, meeting, who's a person who's not telling the truth. You can hear what's happening, and you can translate it. Whereas a person such as yourself, who's a reporter, cannot do that.
Right. So you're saying that you have
more. That's what I love about. Mm-hmm. It's for me. It's called live. It's called being there.
It's the immediacy for you.
And I can't mm-hmm. do that on the blog. The blog's a reading machine, and like I'm very old. Well, I can sit in front of the computer only for about 4 hours, and I barely can stand up afterwards. Plus, it hurts my eyes. Anyway, so I carry the little radio around, and I had a little shortwave radio because I was way up in the mountains, and have, you know, that's just been my life. It's been my whole lifestyle. So I like don't want to say this. I shouldn't say this, but
this is KBOO. You can say it.
The BBC oftentimes will do that, and I love it. They'll just like say, okay, you were in the middle of the, you know, such and such war. What happened? What did you see? What did you see? And then they go to another person who was there. What did you see? You know, it's not the reporter saying, so-and-so said that, you know. I mean, he's not translating the information. Yeah.
Well, thank you for your call.
Yeah, sorry about it.
No. That's what we're here for, is to hear everybody's voices. And not everyone has the same lifestyle. Not everyone sees media the same way.
Yeah, I just don't want translation. I'm not stupid. And I want to be able to, I want to be able to know what's happening without someone telling me
exactly
what's happening, the way they think, you know, it happened. I can comprehend, you know, information and put it into perspective.
Well, so many.
Anyway, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye. And I agree with the caller on so many levels, because too much of our media is spun, is translated for us, and oftentimes I think our younger generations are going to grow up and not really know how to look at a piece objectively because they've been told how to think all their lives.
I'm going to challenge you a little bit on that. Because I think we grew up in an age where there was maybe a main newspaper in town, and I love newspapers, of course. I worked in them for 15 years, but it was a single, you know, institutional voice telling you what was important, you know, sort of deciding what was worth covering, what was not worth covering. And not everybody can go to an event or listen to an event or understand the context if they do. So, I mean, I think good newspapers do that very well, but it still is a limitation. And I think I've heard research, and I can't cite it verbatim, but I think people are doing a lot more sampling, because with the Internet, you can read a story on NewYorkTimes.com and say, you know what, I'm going to go read about the same thing over here. I think news consumers are self-selecting a little bit, and just, you know, are really sort of our browsers now. They're going around and maybe seeing three or four angles on the same topic, which is maybe the next best thing to being there. And maybe some of them are really spun. Maybe some of them are more opinion than firsthand accounts. But I think people have a much better ability to get a broad range of takes on a single issue than they used to.
Well, we do have a wider range of choices, but I do have to say that I miss the days of the news, and I did work in news broadcast. You know, I miss Huntley and Brinkley. Yeah, they were dry, but, you know, it seemed it was to get a much straighter newscast. I know Amy's been just itching to say something about this.
Well, I wanted to get back to something that that Beth said, Melinda, about her desire for and her interest in really unmediated, direct experience with stories. And I think when you're working for social change as an advocacy organization, as we are with My Little Waiting Room, social media has been a tremendous avenue for us to collect people's stories. So as I had mentioned, in the American Express Members Project, we got hundreds of comments from people all over the country who said, I need drop-in childcare at the hospital. Please help fund this project. And so we were able to take those comments and bring them to people who could help influence the social change and bring about My Little Waiting Room at hospitals to bring funding to our organization. So we love getting those direct stories from people, and Facebook lets us do that. We have a SurveyMonkey account where people can tell us their stories. When people go to My Little Waiting Room now, we ask them to comment and collect their stories. And then what we can do is really channel and amplify those stories. It's because collectively, all of those stories add up. They're powerful individually, and then together, they're even more so. And so we really see it as we're creating a movement simply by telling a collection of individual stories. And I think that power of story to get into people's hearts and to minds and to influence change is something that media will come and go, but that power of story will always remain. And so we're just so excited to have these tools available to us to help us in our work of just channeling and amplifying that influence.
Thank you. And I believe we have another caller. Good morning. Good morning, Scott.
Yeah, good morning. A comment and a question. The comment is, I'm just a little concerned where I hear in the context of your program a lot of mentions of, you know, big Wall Street firms, AOL.com, MSN, American Express, and here you are sitting on a local community radio station which is owned by many member listeners, and so it's a completely different breed. And I'd like to then have a question that would bring it down to where you're actually sitting, which is, would you agree or disagree that maybe the one of the future paths of cable community radio is to basically be kind of a judger? There's so much information that we would end up reading it and trying to boil it down into the best parts and using actual judgment, news judgment, et cetera, music judgment for the music folks, and then present that as best as we can faithfully to our listeners, and then they can build trust that at least if they don't have the time, there are volunteers that have the time that are trying to do the best we can to either inform or to entertain people.
Well, Scott, I think, and as a member, I can at least say for myself, I think that's what we already do here at KBOO. KBOO's charter, as you know, if you're a member, is to give a voice to those of, in the community who don't have a voice in the mainstream media. And while, yes, we are talking this morning about how mainstream media affects us, I am a KBOO member, but yet I do have a Twitter account and I have a Facebook page. And I think that, and I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, I think KBOO does that because we all have different perspectives, issues that are near and dear to our hearts. And as you know, anyone can come in and be part of KBOO and can produce a show. They can interview an author. They can read poetry. They can play music. So I think that we're already fulfilling that need.
Right, right. And I don't want to make you defensive. I just wanted to make the point that what I'm hearing from the program so far is from a perspective of major media and or you know, Wall Street firms. And I'd just like to maybe bring that back around to where you're actually sitting. And let's perhaps maybe we can talk more about, you know, how can KBOO engage with the social media. I mean, we even have our new PM News and Public Affairs Director going to study up on this and at Stanford. So there's an opportunity for us to reevaluate. So that's all I'm doing, just
right.
Putting out a challenge that we reorient perhaps the conversation to a community radio station-based orientation.
Well, and thank you, Scott. And that
thank
is true. Jenka Soderberg has received a fellowship, and she's going to be at Stanford. And one of the things that I've always felt about community radio is that it did fill that niche, but this is Portland, and we're very lucky to have all of the media outlets that we do, all the bloggers, all the alternative lifestyles, and people are very active. However, we still get our news feeds from Pacifica. And yes, even though that is an independent news source, it's still more of a conglomerate. Somebody is already deciding what's important. And whether that comes from AP or it comes from Reuters or it comes from Pacifica, somebody is already deciding your news. And I guess what our focus today is really how social media is changing that focus. And, you know, Steve, who's the editor of City Life in Las Vegas, maybe you can talk about, you work for an alternative weekly. What kind of news sources do you use to generate your larger stories?
Well, we have reporters definitely out in the community hunting for news. I should say City Life's kind of unique in the sense that we are an alternative weekly, but we are owned by a company that owns the big daily in town, and that company is a newspaper chain which is owned by a family in Arkansas called the Stevens family. They're a banking and investment family, so we have our own corporate masters, and the their chains are attached to us. Now we try to stretch those chains as far as we possibly can, because I think of all the newspapers in the Stevens Media conglomeration, City Life is unique in the sense that it is probably the only liberal newspaper, the only paper that puts out liberal opinion on a weekly basis here in Las Vegas, and kind of strains against that corporate mold, and definitely tries to get beyond both in the news and the culture coverage down here in Las Vegas. And in Portland, you may be surprised to hear this, but there is in fact culture and art in Las Vegas as well. certainly not as advanced as it is in Portland, but we're working on it. And part of City Life's mission is to kind of promote that and shine a light on that and find good things that are happening here for people who are kind of more independently minded and less inclined to be enthralled to that the corporate meme that our last caller was talking about.
So because you are part of this corporation, then do you receive your traditional news source like AP, Reuters, that kind of wire service information?
You know, it's funny. I don't. We don't use, like, for example, AP Wire to generate story ideas.
Okay.
We don't even use the daily paper. In fact, I tell reporters, look, if something's already been in the daily paper, you better have a much better angle on it if we're going to even write the story. Because if it's already out there, you know, why does somebody want to read something they've already read? So we have to get them out there looking for stories. And as I said before, you know, you think at the beginning, well, this daily paper's got 120 reporters. There's a second paper in town. They have, I'm not sure how many reporters, but we'll say at least 30. So we're talking about 150 people who are already beating the bushes for news in arts and culture, in the courts, and in everywhere. So how do we counter that? And I'm telling you, every week we have stories that the daily paper doesn't have. In fact, on a couple of occasions that I can remember, the daily papers tried to pilfer some of our stories because they missed them. And it's the news is out there, and I think this speaks to the caller's point, and that is that you know, when you have people who are kind of oriented differently in mind, that, you know, we're not the daily newspaper, we're not going to do the paper of record kind of thing, which when we go down to the city council and we write the story about every little item the city council did. We don't do that. We try to find better stories. We try to find more meaningful stories, stories that people, you know, that really affect their lives. There's a community in Las Vegas called West Las Vegas. It's primarily a black community. And there was a road that connected that community to the downtown, into which the city's put a lot of money and a lot of efforts to kind of spruce things up. Well, that street, called F Street, was closed as they did a freeway project. It was literally just closed. A wall was put up. Now, City Life broke that story. The daily paper couldn't be bothered with it. They didn't think it was news until, of course, we broke it. It became a huge controversy, and finally the state legislature stepped in to order the local governments and the Nevada Department of Transportation to reopen that street. That happened, I believe, as a result of the journalism that City Life did, and that wouldn't have happened otherwise if it was up to the daily paper. So, you know, it's just a matter of getting out there with a kind of a different mindset, a different orientation into finding the news, and in some cases ignoring the what you would call traditional corporate sources of news.
Well, and I think that's what alternative weeklies, and actually just, you know, general weeklies do best. And same here at KBOO. When you look at who your community is, that's where your stories are generated. So when you're out in the trenches, you're on the streets. And KBOO, we're very fortunate because we have all, you know, hundreds of people coming in through the week who have different backgrounds, different nationalities, they have different interests. So we're able to plug in those holes that are missed in traditional media. But once again, you know, back to social media and how it affects news gathering and activism. Do you ever look on Facebook, or do you get stories? Do you get tips? Has it changed the way we've gathered news?
Can I give you an example?
Yeah, sure, Rick, you can talk to it. Whoever wants to speak to it.
Yeah, oh, I was going to say that I got, you know, we get tips via Facebook all the time. We get tips. Sometimes somebody will mention something on Twitter, and we'll take that and run with it. Yeah, all the time that happens.
Okay, Rick?
I was just going to point, my boss is flying to Panama City Beach to be with his parents, and he showed me this blog that's an independent blog in Panama City Beach, Florida, called PCBDaily.com. And, of course, they're in the trajectory of the oil spill. So they definitely have all the traditional follow us on Twitter, follow us on Facebook. But a lot of the news that's being collected now is, you know, one reporter running a small blog can't walk up and down the beach all day. So they're, you know, people are feeding them tips via Twitter, via Facebook, via YouTube, RSS feeds. I mean, they're sort of becoming, you know, it's a single person operation, but I think he gets a lot more reach in the community by, you know, with this huge story that really is going to impact this community by just making readers the reporters. And I think this is a case where that actually kind of works. You know, it's a big story that's going to break over weeks, and people care because it affects their livelihood, so they're all sort of engaged in sort of, you know, gathering info and funneling it to this blog.
And Rick, we have just a few minutes, but I wanted to ask you, I understand that you're involved in a community effort to bring news to the Puget Sound area in a different format. Can you give us a brief overview of what that project means?
Yeah, it's really in its early stages, but I think it has a huge amount of promise. And I think we're thinking about it as something that could be a model for something that happens that could be picked up by other communities. But in January, there was a Journalism That Matters conference here in Seattle, and we actually had people from Portland and from all over the Northwest. It's a great sort of grassroots look at the journalism landscape, which is in, you know, a lot of is very disrupted landscape now. And one of the discussions came out of it was, yeah, there's a lot of interesting things happening in Seattle. We still have a daily paper. We have a paper that's moved online only. We've got two strong alt weeklies, but they're all like little islands. We don't have, you know, you don't have the big media presence like you had in the newspaper monopoly days. How do civic conversations happen? How do people find out what's happening in their community? And we sort of took the idea of the commons, a commonly held space. And again, this is sort of outside my Microsoft thing. How do we create an online space where not only where people can find out what's going on from different news outlets, but also become part of the conversation? We've come up with a proposal. We've got a working group. We're putting the building blocks together. And at first, I thought this is a really interesting discussion, but I think it's actually something that might happen. A lot of civic-minded people in the Seattle area are sort of buying into the concept. So I think this is something that's going to play out. You know, we're thinking of putting a working group together. Well, we have a working group. We're thinking of defining some pilot projects for the next year and really sort of roll out fully in 2012. But we're already talking about technology and funding and all those pieces. And I think it's a place that's sort of unmediated, where people can have a civil and civic conversation about what's happening not only in Seattle but the whole Puget Sound region.
Well, great. So. Thanks. We will be looking forward to that. And coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on Veterans Voice, host Northwest Vets for Peace interview the new executive director of Veterans for Peace, Dennis Lane. They also look at the 60th anniversary of the Korean War. At 10, it's Air Cascadia with Chris Andre and Liam Delta. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, FBI whistleblower Colleen Rowley discusses the attacks on WikiLeaks, and activists from the Poor People's Economic and Human Rights Campaign talk about their march from New Orleans to the World Social Forum in Detroit. And at 11, Mara Cullen hosts Radio Free Ireland, public affairs, news, culture, and music from Ireland and beyond. And we're just wrapping up our discussion this morning on Positively Revolting Talk about how social media is changing the landscape of activism and journalism. And joining me this morning has been Steve Sebelius from City Life in Las Vegas, and Rick Vanderknife from MSN in Seattle, and Amy Patterson from My Little Waiting Room. Do any of you have any closing thoughts? We have about 2 minutes.
I just wanted to say thank you, Melinda. You know, having KBOO here as a local community resource has actually been an inspiration to us at My Little Waiting Room. Once we were listening to this program and we heard someone talk about their work as bringing about a gentle revolution to social change, and that's something that really we heard and has been something we've carried forward. So thanks for being here and for the good work that you're doing.
Well, and I just want to tell all of our listeners that KBOO is one of the oldest community radio stations in the country, and I think we're on our 42nd year. And thank you all for listening. Coming up, like I said, at 9 o'clock is Veterans Voice and Positively Revolting Talk. We'll be back next Friday with Ani and Lynn. Like, I know he's going to be reading.
Sounds good. Forget. I'm not sure I could. They say time heals everything.